Last week we saw a number of problems with David and his family. We saw that the sins that David introduced into his family, especially through the adultery and murder involved with getting Bathsheba, that those created problems in his household, both for himself and disciplining his kids, and in things that were permissible to his kids, and created some very big problems. We saw murder, we saw deception, we saw a coup attempt, trying to take over the kingdom by one of his sons, and we saw problems in David's family as a result of the sin that crept into his life. Today we're going to finish up the story of David and then see the transition to the next king, the third king of Israel. And it turns out to be one of David's sons, and we'll see how that happens and who that is. And we'll talk a little bit about the beginning of that third king's kingship. So to bring us into that, I mentioned to you that that king is going to be one of David's sons. I mentioned to you that we saw problems last week with David's sons. Who are David's sons? Well, we find that in 2 Samuel chapter 3 and in chapter 5. In chapter 3, we see the first six sons that David had. Chapter 3, it says that sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon, okay, the son of Ahinoam of Jezreel. His second, Kileab, the son of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream, the son of David's wife, Eglah. All these six were born to David in Hebron. And so there we see the top six heir apparents to the throne. In last week's lesson, we saw some of those involved. The oldest we see was Amnon. Kileab the second, we never hear of him again. And there are times where we should hear of him again if he was there. We think that maybe he died young. And then we heard about Absalom last week. Today we're going to hear about Adonijah. The other sons that were born to David after he left Hebron, we see that in chapter 5, starting at verse 13. It says, after he left Hebron, David took more concubines and wives in Jerusalem, and more sons and daughters were born to him. These are the names of the children born to him there: Shemua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. Okay? All of those very well, you're very well familiar with, right? You've heard of them much, right? I bet there's probably only one name in there that you've heard. And you'll hear a little bit more about him today. Now, why so many sons? Why so many kids? Well, he had lots of wives. You kind of saw that more so where the wives were named in the first passages there in chapter 3. And you also see that some of these wives were political wives. For instance, like we talked about this last week, that Absalom was the son of Maacah, who happened to be the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. So by marrying Maacah, that created an alliance between Geshur and Israel and created peace between those nations. So you've got some political marriages here. What was his first political marriage? Remember getting married to Michal, the daughter of Saul. And you see he continued that. So he had lots of wives. So does that mean that having lots of wives are good? In fact, having these many wives and concubines, it talks about having concubines, which are female cohorts that are not married to him, were those blessings from God for this king? Well, if you turn back to Deuteronomy 17, it talks about the king and what the king should expect. Actually, you can go from verse 14 through verse 20, and it says, God gives these commands. When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and has taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, oh, let's set us a king over us like all the nations around us. Now, this was written hundreds of years before they came to Samuel at the beginning of 1 Samuel and told him that they wanted a king. So here we have, God already knows that's going to happen. And you say, be sure to appoint, God says, be sure to appoint over to you the king that the Lord your God chooses. Don't go pick a king of your own. Take the king that God chooses. Okay, and so far we've seen that. God chose Saul, God chose David. So we've seen that so far with the kings. He must be from among your own brothers. Okay, so don't place a foreigner over you, one who's not a brother Israelite. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. Remember that verse. We'll hear about that later today. For the Lord has told you, you're not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And most importantly, when he takes the throne of his kingdom, he's to write for himself on a scroll the copy of this law. So the king himself would copy the law. Why? Well, that puts it in his mind a whole lot better, right? When you write notes down and you're taking notes in class or when you copy something, that helps you remember it, okay? So he's to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the priests who are the Levites. The scrolls are the property of the priests. It's to be with him, that scroll that he copies, is to be with him, and he's to read it all the days of his life so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees and not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel. So bottom line, within those instructions to Israel on when you have a king and talking about the need for the king to be faithful, the king to know the law, and the king to follow the law, that law containing stipulations about the king not gathering up a bunch of horses, but also that next verse, not taking many wives. Okay? What was God's design for marriage? One man, one woman. Instead, we see David's approach here. Okay? And so, because David did it, does that make it right? No, David is a sinful human just like we are. God commanded the king to have one wife just as everyone else. Don't let the king think that he's better than anyone else, that verse said, and that the law doesn't apply to him, because it applies to him just as it applies to anyone else. Okay? So those are the sons of David. Now, what about those sons? Well, the first one was Amnon. We talked about him last week. And we saw a little bit of a story in chapter 13 of 2 Samuel. We saw that, just to kind of summarize it, starting in verse 28, we see that, you see at the beginning of chapter 13 that Amnon falls in love with his sister, his half-sister, the daughter of Maacah, the same mother of Absalom, and the girl's name's Tamar. Falls in love with her, ends up raping her. As a result, Absalom hates Amnon. And what ends up happening, verse 28, it says, Absalom ordered his men, listen, when Amnon is in high spirits from drinking wine, and I say to you, strike Amnon down, then kill him. Don't be afraid. Have not I given you this order? Be strong and brave. So Absalom's men did to Amnon what Absalom had ordered. Then all the king's sons got up, mounted their mules, and fled. Okay, and then later on, in verse 32, a summary, Jonadab, the son of Shimea, David's brother, said, my lord should not think that they killed all the princes, only Amnon is dead. This has been Absalom's expressed intention ever since the day Amnon raped his sister Tamar. Okay, so we see that what happened to Amnon, he was murdered by his brother Absalom. Why? Because he had raped his sister. That wasn't obvious immediately. That's why Jonadab had to speak up. The initial thought was, well, Amnon's the oldest, he's the heir apparent. Kileab, we think, is gone, the second son. So that makes Absalom the next in line. So it looks like he's staging a coup. It looks like he is laying claim to the right of the throne as being the next son that's alive. And the thought was that not only would he kill Amnon, but he'd have to kill all the other brothers so that none of the other brothers would pose a threat to try to take the kingdom from him, okay, or try to kill him to make them be the next in line, okay. So that's what happened to Amnon. What happened to Absalom? Well, that was the rest of the story that we looked at last week, and we kind of see the conclusion of that in chapter 18. Basically, Absalom decided that he did want to become the next king. There's an idea that people had that they thought that he wanted to be. Well, then he decided he did. But he wasn't ready to wait for David to die. Okay? So instead what he did is he took the bull by the horns and staged a coup. And then there ended up being this big battle between Absalom supporters and David supporters. And we saw the results of that battle in chapter 18. Now Absalom, verse 9, happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak. Absalom's head got caught in the tree, and he was left hanging in midair, while the mule he was riding kept on going. Okay, this is that picture you see from Sunday school days of Absalom hanging in a tree. And then word gets to Joab, the commander of David's army, that Absalom's hanging there, and he says, verse 14, I'm not going to wait like this for you. So he took three javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. And 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. Okay, so you see that he was just kind of hanging around out in the tree, and Joab, David's commander, army commander, killed him to stop the threat of this coup attempt. Now, that's not what David wanted. David loved Absalom and wanted Absalom to be kept safe. And so he was very upset when he learned that Absalom had died. Okay? We've seen a number of times that David was not real happy with Joab. Okay? Joab was a nephew that he had put in charge of his army. David was the king, so you'd think he could just tell Joab to take a hike and he's no longer the commander of his army. But Joab was way too powerful for David. And David knew that if he did that, that Joab could have the upper hand. Joab had the army at his disposal, and he and his brother were just too powerful for David. So he commented a few times that there's nothing he could do about him. But he sure didn't trust him and sure didn't like a lot of the stuff that they did. Okay? So that's where we left it last week, is that Absalom has died. David was upset about that. We see that Joab came to David because the men had this great victory over this rebellious group trying to take the kingdom. And instead of being excited about that and happy about that, David was very upset because his son, Absalom, the big enemy, had been killed. And as a result, the soldiers came in as if they had lost the battle, dejected, okay, rather than victorious. And Joab went to David and said, look, you better straighten up. If you keep acting like this, you're not going to have anybody supporting you anymore. Everybody's going to leave you before nightfall, okay? These men risked their life for you. You're showing them that their lives meant nothing to you. That you would prefer that if your son was alive and all of us were dead. Well, if you want anybody to support you, you better straighten up and get out there and congratulate them on their victory. And so we see that he did, and that was in the beginning of chapter 19. Okay, now at this time, David is not in Jerusalem. Remember, he's run away. So he's over on the other side of the Jordan River, and we see that he does not go back to Jerusalem right away. Why not? Well, he's just had a coup attempt. That coup attempt was not just Absalom and a few men. Absalom had spent years winning the hearts of the people to him and saying, you know, if I were only in charge here, I would make sure that you were taken care of. And he was a friend of the common people. So just because Absalom was gone does not mean that it was safe for David to go back. Okay? He had been rejected as king by the people, is what it looks like. So before he goes back to be their king again, they need to welcome him back. And so we see in chapter 19, starting at verse 9, it says, throughout all the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with each other, saying, the king, David, delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He's the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he's fled the country because of Absalom. And Absalom, who we anointed to rule over us, has died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back? Okay. So there were arguments about, should we bring him back? Should we invite David back or not? Should we, we've kicked him out. He's not going to be real happy, but should we bring him back? So nothing happened. It was this stagnant discussion that never made any progress. So David kind of intervened. What did he do to help make something happen? Verse 11, King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar. These are the priests that he had left there in Jerusalem. Okay, and he had, those men had contact with the other officials who were there. Okay, he said, ask the elders of Judah. Okay, Judah just being the southern tribe. Why should you be the last to bring the king back to his palace, since what's being said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? Okay, so Judah, look, David's part of you. Why should you be the last one? We're hearing what the rest of Israel is saying, but why don't you step up? You're my brothers, my own flesh and blood, in verse 12. So why should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa. And Amasa was the guy that Absalom had chosen and put over his army. Okay, the commander of his army. And he says, say to Amasa, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab. Okay, so by doing this, he's doing two things. He's taking care of the problem that he sees with Joab. Joab just killed his son. Joab has already killed Abner, the commander of Saul's army. Okay, Joab is just a bull in a china closet. He's a loose cannon. Someone that David's got to be afraid of. And so here he's taking care of that. But on top of that, the bigger thing he's doing is he's winning the hearts of the people that supported Absalom. Amasa was the commander of Absalom's army. By making him the commander of the nations of his army, what's David doing here? He's bringing Absalom's army over to his side and saying, no hard feelings, we're all together, you're part of me, I'm not going to come hunt you all down. We're not going to continue this civil war. You're all part of me. So a very good strategic move for a number of reasons here. And then what was the result of that? Well, you see that in verse 14. He won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. And then they sent word to the king, return, you and all your men. And the king returned and went as far as Jordan, and the men of Judah came to go out and meet him. So you see that he appealed to his own tribe of Judah to take the initiative, and they did. Okay. Did this help restore peace to the nation? Well, going on, you skip a bunch of stuff. Go to verse 41. It says, soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying, why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all his men? Okay. All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, we did this because the king's closely related to us. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything for ourselves? Okay, he's our brother. We brought him back. Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in this king, and besides, you have a greater claim on David than we have a greater claim on David than you have. So, why did you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak about bringing back our king? But the men of Judah responded even more harshly than the men of Israel. So, okay, sure, the men of Israel were the first to talk about bringing back David, but they didn't do it. They never brought him back. They never invited him back. It's the men of Judah who did so, but again, it took David's prompting. And so you see this animosity between the northern tribes and the southern tribe of Judah that is just getting silly here. Okay? This jealous anger that they have here. How does this argument escalate? Chapter 20. Now a troublemaker named Sheba, son of Bichri, a Benjamite, happened to be there. He sounded his trumpet and shouted, we have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, O Israel. So all the men of Israel deserted David to follow Sheba, son of Bichri, but the men of Judah stayed by their king all the way from Jordan to Jerusalem. Sounds like a little bit of discussion could have been had here. But you see the arguments got more and more rougher and rougher, so much that it ended up creating the split. The split that David was trying to heal after Absalom's rebellion, it gets bad again. Okay, and the northern tribes of Israel go away from David and follow this guy named Sheba. okay, who sets himself up as king of the northern tribes. How did David respond to this in a way that would win over Absalom's supporters? Because that's really what he's dealing with, or the supporters of Absalom. Verse 4. The king David said to Amasa, okay, remember Amasa was the leader of Absalom's army, and he had already said that Amasa is going to be his king, his commander. Summon the men of Judah to come to me within 3 days and be here yourself. Okay? So he's giving the commander in chief, or his army commander, a command to go gather the troops. But here, he didn't have any troops in Israel, right? Amasa's from Israel, but here he sends him out and says, go gather the troops of Judah. That's the only troops that we have. Okay, but he is looking at Amasa as being that one. So he goes and gathers troops. The problem is, he took too long. It says, you know, in 3 days, come back with him. Okay, and in verse 5 it says, he took longer than the time the king had set for him. In verse 6, David said to Abishai, now Sheba, son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom did. Take your master's men and pursue him, or he will find fortified cities and escape from us. So, 3 days passed, and Amasa wasn't back. And David says, we're losing our window. We've got to pursue these guys before they go into hiding. We've got to take care of this problem. And so he told Abishai, who was Joab's brother, okay, they were kind of partners in crime here, says, gather your men and go chase them down. I can't wait any longer. Okay, so verse 7, Joab's men and the Kerethites and all the people with them marched out under Abishai and went looking for Sheba. Now, Amasa eventually gathers his troops and meets up with the other army, meets up with Joab and Abishai, and what happens? Verse 9. Joab said to Amasa, how are you, my brother? Then Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Amasa was not on his guard against the dagger in Joab's hand, and Joab plunged it into his belly, and his intestines spilled out onto the ground. Without being stabbed again, Amasa died. Then Joab and his brother Abishai pursued Sheba, son of Bichri. Why did Joab kill Amasa? Because Amasa was taking his job. Okay, just as he had, for the same reason he had killed Abner, the commander of Saul's army. He kills Amasa, now the commander of David's army, but Joab wasn't going to let that happen. And so he reacts in the way that he would react. Well, okay, we still have the problem of Sheba out there. Joab and Abishai go chase him down, and were they able to catch up with Sheba? Verse 15. All the troops with Joab came and besieged Sheba in Abel-Beth-Maacah. They built a siege ramp up to the city, and it stood against the outer fortifications. Abel-Beth-Maacah is a long ways away from Jerusalem. If you look at a map of Israel, you see way in the north, north of Galilee, very, very far north part, you see a town called Dan. Dan was a major city later on for the Israelites. Abel-Beth-Maacah was north of that. So Sheba was going away as far as he could to be able to gather troops and to get away from David chasing him down while he built himself up in power. So they find him there. They besiege the town, which means that nobody can get in or out. And they put up siege ramps. They put up efforts to try to knock down the walls or to get over the walls so that they could attack the city and kill everybody in it, and in the process kill Sheba and all his supporters. Well, while they're doing that, what happens? Okay, while they were battering the wall to bring it down, in verse 15, a wise woman called from the city, listen, listen, tell Joab to come up here so I can speak to him. He went toward her and she said, are you Joab? He said, I am. She said, listen to what your servant has to say. I'm listening, he said. He said, you know, this is a peaceful town, she goes on to say. And then, you know, we're peaceful and faithful in Israel. You're trying to destroy a city that is, it's a mother in Israel. Why do you want to swallow up the Lord's inheritance? Oh, far be it from me, Joab replied. Far be it from me to swallow up or destroy. That's not the case. A man named Sheba, son of Bichri, from the hill country of Ephraim, has lifted up his hand against the king, against David. Hand over this one man, and I'll withdraw from the city. Okay, that's really all I want. I want to stop Sheba. The woman said to Joab, his head will be thrown to you from the wall. Then the woman went to all the people with her wise advice, and they cut off the head of Sheba, son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. He sounded the trumpet, and the men dispersed from the city, each returning to his own home. And Joab went back to the king in Jerusalem. So there we go. We didn't have to destroy this town or kill all the people in the town to stop the threat of Sheba. Instead, this wise woman intervened, and Sheba was killed, and the threat was abated. Okay? So here we have another threat to David's kingship. Okay, one within his family we saw last week with Absalom, and now this other one. We see this trouble between the tribes, between the northern tribes and the southern tribe of Judah. Okay, we kind of saw that earlier where when David became king first, he was anointed king or accepted as king of the southern tribe, Judah. All the northern tribes didn't accept him. Instead, they accepted Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. So you saw that split from there. Okay, this split we'll see again after a little bit. All right, the next few chapters have got a number of other stories telling the rest of the story of David's reign. Okay, David's reign finishes up in 2 Samuel, and 1 Kings then kicks off the next king. So that's a good, easy split to remember when you're trying to remember, you know, where are these stories. Okay, David's story is in 2 Samuel. Okay, Saul's story is in 1 Samuel as well as Samuel's story. So you got Samuel and Saul in 1 Samuel. David's story in 2 Samuel. The next king, Solomon, that we'll talk about, kicks off in 1 Kings. And it kind of goes on into some other kings. And you kind of see a split between 1 Kings and 2 Kings being more a split between Elijah and Elisha than you do between kings. Yeah, you kind of have a king split there too with the Ahab being right at that split there. So the chapters that we have here, a couple that we've kind of looked at already. Chapter 19, we've seen some of the stories there. We see chapter 19 deals with David returning to Jerusalem. We also see some stories that we didn't read here. Remember Shimei, the guy who cursed David when he was fleeing Jerusalem from Absalom? And Abishai wanted to chop off his head, and David said, no, because he might be doing this because God's telling him to do this. And if so, then it's not right for us to stop him. Well, you know, he came back and Sheba came to him, bowed down and asked for forgiveness for the way he had acted and pledged his allegiance to David. So we see there in chapter 19 how David reacts. What does he do? We see an act of forgiveness here. We see a very gracious act on David's part and says, I promise I will not kill you. In fact, at this time, Joab and Abishai want to kill him again. But for the way he had acted, you see in verse 21, Abishai says, shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed. And David said, what part do I have with you, Abishai and Joab? You guys, I don't have anything to do with you. Okay, what you want to do, I'll do the opposite. And so he forgives Shimei. You next see he meets up with Mephibosheth. And remember, Ziba, Mephibosheth's servant, had come to David when David was fleeing and had told this story to David that Mephibosheth saw this as an opportunity to become king, and so he had stayed behind in Jerusalem. And David said, well then, to heck with Mephibosheth. Everything that Mephibosheth owned is now yours, Ziba. Okay. Well, now he meets up with Mephibosheth, and he says, hey, why didn't you go with me? And he says, well, I wanted to, and I asked Ziba to saddle up my donkey so I could go, but he ran away instead, and he made up this story against me to you. And David is a little confused here and not sure who's telling the truth and who isn't. I kind of think that Mephibosheth is telling the truth. He's got a clearer story. Plus, you kind of see in verse 24 that Mephibosheth had not taken care of his feet or trimmed his mustache or washed his clothes from the day that David had left until the day that he returned safely. Well, is that the sign? Is that someone who's trying to become king? No. So I think Ziba should have been punished here. But instead, what David decides to do, because he's not sure, is he says, okay, y'all split it. Okay, Ziba takes half, Mephibosheth takes half. And then you see Mephibosheth's response to that. He says, no, verse 30, let him take everything. Okay, all I care about is that you're back safe. Okay, you've welcomed me into your home, and I'm thankful for that you're safe and back. Okay. The other thing that we see is he talks to Barzillai. Barzillai is a guy who helped him out when he was fleeing, and where he fled to. Barzillai came is a wealthy man, an old man, 80 years old. We see in verse 32, and he provided provisions for David and all his men that were and all his people that were fleeing because they fled and they needed food and drink and all that. And so he invited Barzillai to come back to Jerusalem and live in his palace with him. And Barzillai said, look, I'm an old man. It's best if I just stay here and die at home and be buried with my fathers and all that. But, you know, here's Kimham, and I'm not sure who Kimham is, maybe his son or something. He says, you can take him if you want. And David says, sure, he's welcome to come. I'll do anything you ask me, Barzillai. So you see this great gratitude that David has for him. So you see his reaction to all three people, Shimei, Mephibosheth, and Barzillai, is very gracious and thankful for to God for what he's done. Shimei certainly didn't deserve the kind of treatment that David gave him. Mephibosheth, in a typical way that you treat your predecessor's descendants, and especially if there's perceived threats, you sure don't treat him like he treated him there. And then you see that how he did try to treat Barzillai out of thanksgiving for what he did. In chapter 20, you've got the Sheba rebellion, and in there you have the story of Joab killing Amasa that we looked at, and then also the Sheba rebellion and Sheba being killed. So that story that we just talked about. Chapter 21 is an inserted story here where there was trouble in the land, and I guess David inquired of God and found that, it's because the Gibeonites were so abused back during Saul's time. You remember the Gibeonites were the ones who the Israelites had made a covenant with early on in the days of Joshua, when they came and deceived Joshua and the Israelites to think that they were from a far away land, and they made this covenant of peace, and then they found out that the Gibeon was right there in their backyard. But they had made this covenant. Well, Saul didn't like them, and Saul exterminated a bunch of them. Okay, he had a holocaust of Gibeonites. He didn't get rid of all of them, but he got rid of a lot of them, and that never had been made right. Well, how do you make something like that right? Well, what David offered to them and said, what can I do to make it right? And that's what you see in chapter 21, verse 3. It says, you know, what shall I do for you? How can I make amends so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance? And they said, well, we don't have any right to ask for silver or gold or even to put anybody to death. And he said, well, what do you want us to do? What would you like me to do? He said, well, Give us seven of Saul's male descendants so that we can execute them, and that will make things right. I'm not sure how that makes things right, but that's what they asked for, and David said okay. And David grabbed two sons of Saul's through one of his concubines, and five grandsons, and turned them over to the Gibeonites. They killed them and exposed their bodies and got their revenge, got their vengeance. You also have here then at the end of chapter 21 some wars against the Philistines. Okay, some interesting stories in there you may want to look at. Chapter 22, we have a big song of praise. Talks a lot about how God has protected him and taken care of him and what God's done for him. And this is also Psalm 18. You find this back in the Psalms, of Psalm 18. But we have it there again in 2 Samuel 22. Chapter 23, we have some other words of David, some more poetry here, followed by David's mighty men. You have three the three, they're called three super mighty men. Okay, and you've got stories about them there. And then we see a list of the 30. Okay, there's also another 30 mighty men. And so all those people are listed there. You'll find people in there like Uriah the Hittite is the very last of the 30. Okay, we know who that is, right? And in fact, Bathsheba's dad is in there as well. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. I don't see it right off, but he's in there. Chapter 24, we see that David takes a census. Now, a census in itself is not evil. The purpose of this census wasn't to find out how many people are in the land, but how many fighting men are in the land. How big is my army? Okay. And Joab spoke up and said, David, don't do this. This isn't good. Okay. We're trusting God to provide the strength and to protect us, and you shouldn't be looking to your own strength. David said, I don't care. Do it anyway. And they go and they take this census. And then God's anger comes up against him, and God comes to him and says, okay, I'll give you three choices. Okay, this is wrong. And we see David was conscience stricken. We see in verse 10 and says to God, I've sinned greatly in what I've done. Now take away the guilt of your servant. I've done a very foolish thing. But then God sent a prophet and said, I'll give you three options. You get to choose. Do you want 3 years of famine in the land? Or do you want 3 months of fleeing from your enemies while they pursue you? Or do you want 3 days of plague in your land? Okay, think it over and let me know what you want. And he says, look, let me fall in the hands of God, not in the hands of men. In other words, where enemies pursue me. God has great mercy, so let me fall into his hands. And so we have a 3-day plague, and you have that story in there. After that plague, we see that God accepts an offering from David that stops the plague after that third day. Okay? So that's the rest of the story of David. We then move on. 1 Kings talks about the next generation here. Okay? So, who is next in line? Well, first was Amnon. He's dead. Then was Kileab. We think he's dead. Right? And then we have Absalom. We know he's dead. And then the fourth, Adonijah, chapter 3, verse 4, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. Okay? So, he is the heir apparent. He's the one who looks to be the next king. So, let's see. Does he get to be the next king? Do we have a precedence of the oldest son being the next king? No. Okay? In fact, it was very clear even to the oldest son of the prior king, to Jonathan, that he was not going to be the next king, that God had chosen someone else, that God had chosen David. And he accepted that. He recognized that, and he accepted that. Okay? But other nations do it this way. So what's going to happen here? Let's take a look. So, as David gets old, okay, chapter 1, 1 Kings, when King David was old and well advanced in years, he could not keep warm even when they put covers over him. Okay? And at this time he's about 70 years old. He dies when he's 70. Okay? Verse 5, Adonijah, the next in line, right? Whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, "I'll be king." So he got chariots and horses ready with 50 men to run ahead of him. Okay? So Adonijah decided, I'm going to be king. Dad really can't handle it anymore. It's time for the next king. Okay? And I want to make sure that I'm that guy. So he gets chariots and horses and 50 men to run ahead of him as he goes down the street riding in this chariot. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Remember last week, 2 Samuel 15. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and 50 men to run ahead of him. Okay? He's copying his brother Absalom. Absalom had a great idea with this. Okay? Absalom did a great job of winning the hearts of the people, of letting everyone realize that and accept that he's the next king. And what was the first thing Absalom did? Is he got this chariot and he had 50 men run ahead of him so that If someone's out in the street and 50 men are running ahead, making a way, you're thinking somebody important's coming. And sure enough, here comes Adonijah. Okay, so Adonijah, he's not real creative. He's taking what he already saw happen here. Did David stop Adonijah before things got out of hand? Because we saw how things got out of hand with Absalom. Verse 6, his father had never interfered with him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" By the way, he was also very handsome, and he was born next after Absalom. Again, we see David's lack of discipline, lack of control of his sons, results in trouble. Okay, what should David do here? He should stop his son from doing this. He should stop Adonijah, but he doesn't. Okay, so while Adonijah just continues to go on, what kind of support does he get? We don't see that he takes the trouble that Absalom did in terms of trying to win the hearts of the people. Okay, and to be honest, in Adonijah's thought, Dad is old, he's on his deathbed, it's time for a new king, I'm obviously the next king, so I'm just gonna start doing this, okay? And he checks around, verse 7, he confers with Joab, okay, the commander of the army, right, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the high priest, and they gave him their support. So he's going, okay, well, this is cool. And so, but, verse 8, Zadok the priest, okay, which is Abiathar's brother, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, and Rei, and David's special guard did not join Adonijah. Okay, so he got some support, but he didn't get all the support. He didn't get the second priest or David's special guard. We see that Adonijah then sacrificed sheep, cattle, and fattened calves on the stone of Zoheleth near Enrogel. He invited all of his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah who were royal officials, but he did not invite Nathan the prophet or Benaiah or the special guard or his brother Solomon. He invites all his brothers except for Solomon. Why is that? Well, let's see. Let's just keep going. By the way, when he went to do this sacrifice, why did he do that? And he brought all these important people with him, his brothers, these leaders. Why did he do that? Well, turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 15, verse 11. It says that 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come from Gilo, his hometown, and so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. Why did Adonijah do the sacrifice and invite all these important people to it? He's just following Absalom's example. Okay, not real creative here, but he saw what happened before, saw how it worked before. He's just going to hope for better results. He did confer with them. That is one difference. He conferred with Joab and Abiathar and got their support. So those are two of the top key people. So looks like things are okay. Well, was he to be the next king? Well, who's supposed to be the king? Remember back in the Deuteronomy verse that we read that it said to make sure that whoever's your king is the one that the Lord chooses. That's Deuteronomy 17, verse 15. Okay? So, is Adonijah the one that God has chosen? Well, if we turn to 1 Chronicles, by the way, 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles just parallel 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. So you see a lot of the same stories. As we go on, we'll start bouncing even more and more into the Chronicles because there's some things that are recorded there that are not recorded in the books of the Kings and Samuel. But a lot of what we've covered so far, the Chronicles don't shed a whole lot more light. But here, chapter 22 in 1 Chronicles, verse 7, we see this is David here. And he talks to Solomon. He says, "My son, I had it in my heart to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, but this word of the Lord came to me that you shed much blood, have fought many wars. You're not to build a house for my name because you've shed much blood on the earth in my sight. But you will have a son who will be a man of peace and rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies on every side. His name will be Solomon. Okay, Solomon means peace. Okay, Shalom, you've heard is peace. Actually, Shlomo, which is basically Solomon, means peaceable in Hebrew. I will grant Israel peace and quiet during his reign. He's the one who will build a house for my name. He will be my son, I'll be his father, and I'll establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. So David's telling Solomon that God came to me and told me this, and told me that you would be the next king, that you're the one who's chosen. So God had chosen Solomon, not Adonijah. Might that be, do people know this maybe? Might that be a reason that in verse 10 of 1 Kings chapter 1 that Adonijah did not invite Solomon to his party, to his coronation party? Well, let's go on with the story. Who remembered God's appointment and devised a plan to make Solomon king? Verse 11, then Nathan. Who's Nathan? Nathan is a prophet at this time. Okay, God's a prophet. Nathan asked Bathsheba, okay, you know Bathsheba, she was Solomon's mother, right? Solomon was born to David and Bathsheba. Have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king without our Lord David's knowing it? Okay. Bathsheba, have you heard what Adonijah's done? Okay. Now then, let me advise you how you can save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go into King David and say to him, my lord the king, did you not swear to me your servant? Surely Solomon, your son, will be king after me, and he'll sit on my throne. Well, why then has Adonijah become king? Okay, so he tells her, go into David and say this to him. And then while you're speaking, while you're still there talking to the king, I'll come in and I'll confirm what you said. Okay, because David knows this. David knows that Solomon is to be the next king. He doesn't know what Adonijah's doing, but you can't just go in there and say, hey, what's Adonijah doing? You've got to remind him of what God has said would happen here. So what Nathan then says to Bathsheba, she does, and we have that story played out in the next verses 17 through 27, and Nathan comes in and confirms it, and then David responds, and how does he respond? Does he remember God's appointment and his promise to Bathsheba? Verse 29, the king took an oath, as surely as the Lord lives, who has surely delivered me out of every trouble, I will surely carry out today what I swore to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. Solomon, your son, shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne in my place. And you see what he says here, I will carry this out today. Okay, I'm not going to wait any longer. Adonijah has got to be stopped right now. Because he's not going to be king. Solomon is, and so I'm going to turn over the kingship today, right now. Then verse 33, he said to Zadok and Benaiah, he says, take your Lord's servants with you and set Solomon my son on my own mule and take him down to Gihon. Okay, putting him on the king's mule will be getting the message across there too. There have Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anoint him king over Israel. Blow the trumpet and shout, long live King Solomon. Then you're to go up with him, and he's to come and sit on my throne and reign in my place. I've appointed him ruler over Israel and Judah. They do that, verse 39, Zadok the priest took the horn of oil from the sacred tent and anointed Solomon. Then they sounded the trumpet, and all the people shouted, long live King Solomon. So you see it happens. David transfers the kingship that very day. Well, word of that gets to Adonijah. Okay, Adonijah and all the guests who were with him heard it as they were finishing their feast. On hearing the sound of the trumpet, Joab asked, what's the meaning of all this noise in the city? Even as he was speaking, Jonathan, the son of Abiathar the priest, arrived. Adonijah said, come in, a worthy man like you must be bringing good news. Well, not really, said Jonathan. Our Lord King David has made Solomon king. And he tells the story there. Verse 49, at this, all of Adonijah's guests rose in alarm and dispersed. They got out of there as quick as they can. This ship is sinking, the rats scurried. But Adonijah, in the fear of Solomon, okay, Solomon's now king. Doesn't matter if Adonijah calls himself king or not. Solomon is king, so he's afraid of him. And obviously he's a threat to Solomon. So what does he do? He goes and takes a hold of he goes to the tabernacle and takes a hold of the horns of the altar. Then Solomon was told, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon and is clinging to the horns of the altar. He says, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. Okay, so he's looking to God for protection. Okay, and he's grabbing a hold of the altar to protect him from what he knows is deserved execution for standing up against David and taking the kingship from Solomon that Solomon deserved here. So how does Solomon respond? Okay, this is his first act as new king. Solomon replied, if he shows himself to be a worthy man, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground. But if evil is found in him, he will die. Then King Solomon sent men, and they brought him down from the altar, and Adonijah came, bowed down to King Solomon. And Solomon said, go home. Totally different response than most kings would have to someone who has just staged a coup or just claimed the kingship. But here you see his first act as he follows the graciousness of his father and says, Adonijah, I trust you. As long as you're trustworthy, everything will be fine. But if you cross that line, then you'll do so to your death. Chapter 2, we see that changes. We see in verse 10 that David dies. He rests with his fathers and is buried in the city of David. Okay. And then Adonijah, verse 13, after David is dead, the son of Haggith went to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. Bathsheba asked him, do you come peacefully? He said, oh yes, peacefully. Then he added, I've got something to say to you. You can say it, she replied. Oh, as you know, he said, the kingdom was mine. All of Israel looked to me as their king, but things changed and the kingdom has gone to my brother, for it's come to him from the Lord. Okay, so I don't contest that. God chose him as king. But I do have one request to make of you. Please don't refuse me. You may make it, she said. So he continued, please ask King Solomon, he won't refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. Very well, said Bathsheba. I'll speak to the king for you. So he asks Bathsheba to go to Solomon and ask for permission for him to marry Abishag the Shunammite. Who is Abishag the Shunammite? Go back to 1 Kings chapter 1. We see when 1 Kings changes here, it says that when King David was old and well advanced in years, he could not keep himself warm, even when they put covers on him. So his servant said to him, let's look for a young virgin to attend the king and take care of him. She can lie beside him so that our Lord the king may keep warm. Then they searched throughout Israel for a beautiful girl and found Abishag, a Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The girl was very beautiful. She took care of the king and waited on him. But the king had no intimate relations with her. Okay? So Abishag was a virgin attendant to David in his later years. Okay? In his last years. Okay? So he wanted to marry her. It says she was very beautiful, very pretty, so he wanted to marry her. Is there anything wrong with that? Turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 16 and see if you remember this from last week when we talked about Absalom taking the kingdom from David. And when Absalom goes to Jerusalem, he then asks Ahithophel, who's his great advisor, give me your advice, what should we do? Ahithophel said, lie with your father's concubines whom he left to take care of the palace. Then all of Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench in your father's nostril, and the hands of everyone with you will be strengthened. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and he lay with his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Okay? So, just as what Absalom did is what Adonijah is doing here, is by taking Abishag as his wife, he's laying claim to what was David's, and as you claim the prior king's wives, concubines, you are claiming the kingdom. Okay, that's what's happening here. How does Solomon recognize this, and how does he react? Verse 22. We see that in the prior verses, Bathsheba comes to Solomon and makes this request. King Solomon answered, why do you request Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? You might as well request the kingdom for him. After all, he is my older brother. Yes, for him and Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if Adonijah does not pay with his life for this request. And now, as surely as the Lord lives, he who has established me securely on the throne of my father David and has founded a dynasty for me as he has promised, Adonijah will be put to death today." King Solomon gave orders to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he struck down Adonijah and he died. Okay, remember, he told Adonijah, as long as you're trustworthy and don't show any evil, everything will be fine. But the day that you show that you're not trustworthy and that you are evil and that you show a threat, then you'll die. And this was a threat. And so King Solomon took care of that threat. Now, there were a couple of partners in crime there. Remember, there was Abiathar the priest had sided with Adonijah, and Joab had. How did Solomon treat Abiathar the priest? Verse 26. To Abiathar the priest, the king said, "Go back to your fields in Anathoth. You deserve to die, but I will not put you to death now because you carried the ark of the sovereign Lord before my father David and shared all of my father's hardships." So Solomon removed Abiathar from the high priesthood of the Lord, fulfilling the word of that the Lord had spoken at Shiloh about the house of Eli, that the house of Eli would not have any old men serving the Lord. Okay, so Abiathar is now removed before he gets old. Okay, but he didn't kill him, but he did remove him from his position. And then, what does Joab do when he hears what happened to Adonijah? Verse 28, when the news reached Joab, who had conspired with Adonijah, though not with Absalom, he fled to the tent of the Lord, took hold of the horns of the altar. Okay, he does the same thing Adonijah did. Okay. King Solomon was told that Joab had fled and was hanging onto the altar, and Solomon told Benaiah, "Go strike him down." So Benaiah goes, tells Joab the king says to come out, and Joab says, "No, I'll die here." Benaiah says, "No, this is what Joab said to Solomon." He says, "Okay, go do as he says, strike him down and bury him, and so clear me and my father's house of the guilt of the innocent blood that Joab shed. The Lord will repay him for the blood he shed, because without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked two men, Abner, right, and Amasa, that we talked about today, and killed them with a sword." Okay, oh, here we go. Both of them, Abner son of Ner, commander of Israel's army, and Amasa son of Jether, commander of Judah's army, were better men and more upright than him. May the guilt of their blood rest on the head of Joab and his descendants forever, but on David and his descendants, his house and his throne, may there be Lord's peace forever. Okay, so Benaiah goes and kills Joab. And so Joab is gone now. Solomon's throne is now established. He's king. He's gotten rid of some threats. But you see, he did so graciously and allowed them to live until they did something that forced his hand. There's some other leftover business. Before David died, we see that he gave a charge in chapter 2 to Solomon. He said, "I'm about to go." And he says in verse 5, "Now you yourself know what Joab son of Zeruiah did to me. What he did to the two commanders of Israel's armies, Abner and Amasa, he killed them, shedding their blood in peacetime as if in battle, and with that blood stained the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Solomon, deal with him according to your wisdom. Do not let his gray head go down to the grave in peace." Okay, so he said, deal with Joab. Okay, "but show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead." Okay, remember we talked about him. He had provided for David and his people when they ran away from Absalom. And then verse 8, "remember, you have with you Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, who called down bitter curses on me the day I went to Mahanaim. When he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord that I would not put him to death by the sword. But now, you do not consider him innocent. You're a man of wisdom. You'll know what to do with him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood." Okay? So he said, "I can't kill him. I couldn't do anything about Shimei, but you can. Okay? So take care of him for me. So deal with Joab and deal with Shimei." Those are some leftover business. So did Solomon call for Shimei's death? Verse 36. "King sent for Shimei and said to him, 'Build yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there, but don't go anywhere else. The day you leave Jerusalem and you cross the Kidron Valley, you can be sure that you will die. Your blood will be on your head.' Shimei said, well, what you say is good. The servant will do as my lord the king has said. And he stayed in Jerusalem for a long time. Okay? So he said, you can live in peace, but you have to stay in Jerusalem. You cannot leave Jerusalem. If you do, then you'll do so at the cost of your life. And he says, okay, I can live with that. So, how does Shimei change his own situation? 3 years later, two of Shimei's slaves ran off to Achish, son of Maaca, king of Gath, and Shimei was told, your slaves are in Gath. So at this, he saddled his donkey and went to Achish at Gath in search of his slaves. So Shimei went away and brought the slaves back from Gath. Okay? He left Jerusalem. The one thing that he couldn't do. When Solomon was told that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and had returned, the king summoned him and said, didn't I make you swear by the Lord and warn you that on the day that you leave to go anywhere else, you can be sure you will die? At that time you said, what you say is good and I'll obey. Why then did you not keep your oath to the Lord, to Yahweh, and obey the command that I gave you? Okay. So he changed his own situation there, left Jerusalem in violation of Solomon's order and his own agreement and commitment to God. So how did Solomon handle this? Verse 46, we see that Solomon gave the order to Benaiah. By the way, Benaiah now is the commander of his army, now that he's gotten rid of Joab. And he went out and struck Shimei down and killed him. The kingdom was now firmly established in Solomon's hands. Okay? So now all the threats are gone. But you see, in every case, he acted graciously and offered grace to the threat and allowed the threat to determine their own destiny. And that's what's happened here. Okay? And the kingdom is now firmly established in Solomon's hands. No more threats. Right? All right. Well, what kind of a king was he? Well, we talk about the kingship of David. You talk about a faithful king, a man after God's own heart. Okay? Well, when David passes on the throne to Solomon, what are his last words that we have from David? Chapter 2, when the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. He said, I'm about to go the way of all the earth. So, be strong. Show yourself a man. Observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and requirements as written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go. And that the Lord may keep his promise to me, that if my descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before God with all their heart and soul, will never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. Okay? So, he gives Solomon some instructions to follow God, to obey God, and that God, as a result, would bless him, and would give him descendants, and would bless his descendants, and would continue the dynasty, as long as we remain faithful. So, did Solomon attempt to walk in David's guidance and examples here? Chapter 3, starting in verse 3. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place, and Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. Okay, you'll see more about the high places as we go on, but you see that he followed his father's example, walked according to the statutes of his father. But there's this big exception of offerings on the high places. Why? What's the deal there? Okay, you'll see this as we go on. But just briefly, in chapter 33 of Numbers, this is when Moses is still around. All right, God speaks to Moses. And starting in verse 51, God says, speak to the Israelites and say to them that when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all of their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish their high places. So they were supposed to destroy the people, all their gods, all their altars, all their shrines on their high places. The Canaanites would build altars and shrines on the tops of hills. Okay, those were called high places. And they were supposed to destroy those. It wasn't that worshiping God on the top of a hill is wrong. It's the use of the Canaanite high places that was wrong. And so we see that some of this is being done here at the time of Solomon. Now, it also says here in verse 3 that Gibeon, or I'm sorry, verse 4, that Gibeon was the most important high place. Why was it the most important high place? Well, if you turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 29, you see that at that time, the tabernacle of the Lord, which Moses had made in the desert, and the altar of burnt offering were at that time on the high place at Gibeon. Okay, so this is where, you know, it had been at Shiloh before, it had been a few different places, but now, during Solomon's time, it was there at Gibeah. So Solomon went to Gibeah and offered 1,000 burnt offerings to God, worshiped God there. Okay. While he was there, he had a dream. Verse 5, at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, ask me whatever you want. Okay, whatever you want me to give to you. Solomon said, oh Lord my God, verse 7, you've made your servant king in place of my father David, but I'm only a little child and I don't know how to carry out my duties. So he's young. He's probably no older than 20 at this time is the thought. Your servant here is among the people that you've chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who's able to govern this great people of yours? Okay, so God said, I give you, it's kind of a genie thing, I'll grant you one request. And so he asked for wisdom because he feels that's what he really needs. As a young man, he needs to learn how to wisely lead these people. Okay, know the difference of, use discernment to know the difference between right and wrong. So does God grant his wish? Verse 10. Yahweh was pleased that Solomon had asked for this, so God said to him, since you've asked for this, and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have you asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment and administering justice, I will do what you've asked for. I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never be anyone like you, will have never been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I'll give you what you have not asked for, both riches and honor, so that in your lifetime, you'll have no equal among kings. And if you walk in my ways and obey my statutes and commands as David your father did, I will give you a long life. Okay? And then Solomon awoke from that dream. So God was pleased that he had asked for wisdom. But because he had asked for wisdom, God said, I'm going to give you so much more. I'm going to give you the wisdom that you asked for, but I'll also give you fame and fortune. Okay, people will know you. You'll be famous. You'll be wealthy. There will be peace during your time. And I'll give you a long life as long as you remain faithful to me. Okay, so God blessed him very greatly here. And we then see that he got up and he returned to Jerusalem in verse 15. So he left the high place in Gibeah and then went to Jerusalem and offered burnt offerings and fellowship offerings there and gave a big feast. Okay? Now, next verse, we see his first opportunity to use this wisdom. Okay? Story that should be familiar to you. Now, two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. One of them said, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house. I had a baby while she was there with me. The third day after my baby was born, this woman also had a baby. We were alone. There was no one in the house but the two of us. During the night, this woman's son died because she laid on him. So she got up in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while I, your servant, was asleep. She put him by her breast and put her dead son by my breast. The next morning, I got up to nurse my child, and he was dead. When I looked at him closely in the morning light, I saw that it wasn't the son that I had born. The other woman said, no, the living one is my son, the dead one is yours. Okay, so you've got this argument between these two women about who has the living son and who has the dead son. Well, this is kind of impossible. How would Solomon know? In those days, they didn't have DNA testing. Okay, so how could he tell? Well, it's just a baby. They don't really look like anyone yet. Or he couldn't tell a resemblance. So what does he do? Verse 24. The king said, bring me a sword. So they brought a sword for the king. Then he gave an order, cut the living child in two and give half to one and half to the other. If they're arguing over this kid, let's just split it in half and give each of them half. The woman whose son was alive was filled with compassion for her son and said to the king, please, my lord, give her the living baby. Don't don't kill him. But the other said, neither I nor you shall have him. Cut him in two. And the king gave his ruling. Give the living baby to the first woman. Do not kill him. She is his mother. Okay, so you see his wisdom in action here. He offered to cut the baby in half, and in doing so, he got the responses of the woman that he was looking for and could tell which one was the loving mother. Okay, the mother, the loving mother, would much rather have the son go to someone else than to be killed. And so he uses this God-given discernment to find this out. Okay, what did people think about Solomon's unorthodox action here? Verse 28, when all of Israel heard the verdict the king had given, they held the king in awe because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Okay, so they held him in awe. He had wisdom from God. It wasn't just wisdom, it was wisdom of God. And a very extensive wisdom. We see chapter 4, verse 29, that God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. You couldn't measure how wise this man was. His wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East. And you think of the men of the East. You know, the wise men came from the East. And he was wiser than all of them. He was greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He is wiser than any other man. And it mentions all these wise men here. And his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. Okay. So he was wiser than all others. His understanding was as immeasurable as the sand on the seashore. We then see some examples. Verse 32, he spoke 3,000 proverbs. Proverbs are wise sayings. He passed on his wisdom. People came to hear his wisdom, and he would pass it on, so he didn't keep it to himself. His songs numbered 1,005. Okay, a lot of songs. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also taught about animals and birds and reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. Okay? So people came from all over to hear this wise man speak. Okay? One of the books that we have in our Bible, the book of Proverbs, most of which is written by Solomon. And these are some of the Proverbs that it mentions. Not all the Proverbs that he wrote are in the book of Proverbs, and not all the Proverbs in the book of Proverbs are from Solomon. But you have a lot of this from Solomon. And it starts out, the first few chapters, where Solomon talks about the importance of wisdom. We'll just pull a few verses here out of chapter 3. It says, blessed is the man who finds wisdom, the man who gains understanding. For she's more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. She, that is wisdom, is more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand, and her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant ways, and her paths are peace. Okay? So he talks about how important wisdom is. Wisdom is profitable, very profitable, more profitable than anything that you can think of. Okay? More profitable than silver, more profitable than gold. Okay? It's precious, more precious than the most precious jewels you can think of. Okay? It leads to long life, it leads to honor, it leads to peace, it invigorates you, it gives you blessings. Okay? So he talks about the importance of wisdom. And so if we want wisdom, because it's all that important, sounds like something we would want. And he shares his wisdom with us in the Proverbs and how he lives his life. But he says, you know, if you want wisdom, how do you get it? Where do they come from? Where does wisdom and knowledge come from? Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. Okay? So, where does wisdom come from? It comes from God. It comes from fearing God. It comes from living in a right relationship with God. As we long to know God and live as God has led us to live, then he gives us wisdom and understanding. So, if we want wisdom, what do? Well, we fear God, right? What do we do if we feel that we're lacking wisdom? James 1, James talks about it, verse 5. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. God is the source of wisdom, right? So if we want wisdom, if we want to become wiser than we are, we should look to God and ask God, and He'll grant it to us. Okay? We see that people came from all over, verse 34 of chapter 4, the last verse there. People came from all over to hear His wisdom and see how wise He was. How far is all over? Well, if you look, turn to chapter 10, we'll cover part of chapter, well, we'll cover chapter 10 here in the study too. It says that when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Well, where is Sheba? Sheba is at the southern tip of Arabia, 1,200 miles away, a long distance away. So she heard about his wisdom and she came to check it out. Okay, she came with a lot of hard questions. Was he able to answer those questions? Verse 3, Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. Verse 6, she said to the king, "The report that I heard in my country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I didn't believe these things until I came and saw it with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth, you have far exceeded the report that I heard." So he proved to be much wiser than she expected, wiser than she had heard. Okay? Well, Solomon has the same call that we have, the same call that was given to Abraham, and that is that we are blessed to be a blessing. How did Solomon's wisdom and fame help his call of being blessed to be a blessing? Verse 8, "How happy your men must be," this is the Queen of Sheba still talking, "how happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, He has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness." So how did his wisdom lead to him being blessed to be a blessing? Well, his wisdom helped make others happy, okay, blessed other people, and it brought praise to God from other nations. Here we have the Queen of Sheba from 1,200 miles away praising God for the wisdom that he gave Solomon. She then gives him some gifts. You would have, when kings would get together, they would give each other gifts. And the Queen of Sheba gave lots of gifts here. Verse 10, she gave the king 120 talents. That's 4.5 tons of gold. Okay, a lot of gold, very valuable. Large quantities of spices and precious stones. Never again were so many spices brought in as those that the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. So, 4.5 tons of gold, plus tons of spices, tons of jewels, okay, more than had ever been imported before. Okay, from her, from other gifts that he got, how much gold did Solomon get each year? Now, this doesn't count import taxes and tributes, okay, that tributes that he got from kingdoms that that had to pay protection money to him, if you want to call it that, tribute. It says, verse 14, the weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents, which is 25 tons of gold each year, not including the revenues from merchants and traders and from all the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. Okay? So, very wealthy. How extravagant did things become for Solomon during this time? Verse 21, and I'm skipping a lot of verses, and you may want to read those, verses 16 through 29. Verse 21, all of King Solomon's goblets were gold, and all the household articles in the palace of the forests of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's day. Verse 27, the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. So things became very extravagant. Even household articles were made out of gold. Silver was commonplace. Nobody cared about silver because it was so common. Okay. We also see he was a great trader and a merchant. Chapter 9, verse 26, we see that King Solomon built ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Elath in Edom, on the shore of the Red Sea. And Hiram, which is the king of Tyre, someone who had become a very strong and important ally with Solomon, sent his men, sailors who knew the Red Sea, to serve in the fleet with Solomon's men. They sailed to Ophir and brought back 420 talents of gold, which they delivered to King Solomon. So he had a fleet of ships on the Red Sea over on the east, and sailed to Ophir, which is down at the southern end of the Red Sea, and traded with people there. Chapter 10, verse 22, we see that the king had a fleet of trading ships at sea. Now, this is talking about the Mediterranean Sea, along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years, it returned carrying gold, silver, and ivory, and apes and baboons, okay, which are very important, I guess. Now, your footnote, NIV footnote, says this fleet of trading ships of Tarshish, which could just be ships of Tarshish design, or it could be saying that these ships sailed to Tarshish. Where's that? That's Spain. Okay, that's as far away, that's the end of the known world. Okay, so what this is basically saying is that he had a fleet of ships that sailed all over the place in the Mediterranean. And then verse 28, it says, Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kew. The royal merchants purchased them from Kew. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 450. They also exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and of the Arameans. So he traded in horses and all that. Which, remember back when we looked at Deuteronomy, and we read that verse, it said that, it's chapter 17, verse 16, the king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. Okay? But Solomon did. Okay? We see a few places where Solomon has some troubles, and we'll talk more about that next week. But we see he's got a fleet of ships on the Red Sea, a big fleet of ships in the Mediterranean Sea, and a lot of land-based trade in Asia and Egypt and Arabia. Okay, so he gets very, very wealthy with all this trade. What else does he do to accumulate wealth? Verse 23 of chapter 10, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom that God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift. Articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons and spices, and horses and mules. So all these people who came to see and hear the wisdom of Solomon brought presents. And he just got more and more extravagant presents and wealthier and wealthier. Okay? So you see his wisdom, and you see that God said that I'll give you that wisdom, I'll give you fame, and you see that people from all over the world hear about him and want to come see him. I'll give you fortune, and you see that he's the wealthiest man ever. Okay, he says, I'll give you peace. Well, what about peace? How peaceful was life during Solomon's reign? Back to chapter 4, verse 24. It says that he ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river, that's the big river, Euphrates River, from Tipshah and to Gaza, and had peace on all sides. Okay, unlike his father, and especially unlike his father's predecessor, Saul. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel from Dan to Beersheba lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. Okay, so things were peaceful. His neighbors were not troublesome. He had peace with his neighbors. Everybody felt safe. Everybody felt safe traveling. They lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. That's kind of like a chicken in every pot. That's kind of what that's saying. Okay. Everybody was happy and safe. Now, I don't know if some of that sounds interesting to you, but go back to Genesis chapter 22 and see what God had promised to Abraham. Abraham had spent his life childless, without any children, and without any land as a nomad, right? And God promised to him numerous times, but we'll just look at chapter 22, verse 17. God says, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. So you see the promise that God made to Abraham to give him, even though he had no son, no children most of his life, that he would have descendants like sand on the seashore. Even though he had no land, except for later on the burial plot that he bought. He would have extensive land. All the land that he could see would be his, and that he would be blessed greatly. Okay. Did Abraham know how much land he would get? Well, turn back to chapter 15.
how much land his descendants would have. 15 verse 18, it says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, to your descendants I give this land, the land where you are in Canaan, from the river of Egypt, or the Wadi of Egypt, okay, which is a little stream there, kind of, to the great river, the Euphrates. Okay, so he says, I'm going to give you this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the Euphrates, the great Euphrates River. How much of these promises were fulfilled under Solomon? Verse 20, back in chapter 4 of 1 Kings. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as sand on the seashore, just as God had promised to Abram. Okay, now it's been fulfilled. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. Okay, you see the blessings that God promised to give to Abraham's descendants. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river, the great river Euphrates, to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. So, just what God said. The boundaries that God said that he would give to Abraham and his descendants, we now see those under Solomon. Okay, God has fulfilled his promise to Abraham so many years ago. Okay, over a thousand years before. All right, let's close with prayer. God our Father, we thank and praise you that you're faithful to your promises and fulfilled your promises to Abraham just as you fulfill your promises to us. We thank and praise you for giving us the example of David and his faithfulness, and the way that you blessed him as a result of that faithfulness, the way that you interacted with him in life, the way that you disciplined him when he needed discipline, the way that you forgave him, all of those things you offer to us, the way that you continue to bless him and his descendants with wisdom and with so many blessings is the same way that you bless us. We thank and praise you for that. Help us to be grateful for that. Forgive us when we're not. Forgive us when we do not live as people with hearts after your own heart, as David did. Send your Spirit into our lives to strengthen us so that we may live in a right relationship with you and experience your blessings, the big blessing of being one with you. We pray in the name of Jesus Christ, the one that you sent out of your love to bring us to you. Amen.